This is Art 10. And the concern today is to try to bring into our consciousness some aspects about art which are very difficult initially to countenance. We're going to make some very strange statements today. And I think maybe in order to help you follow this, I'll come to the page of notes for today. Every week, I usually put a page or two of notes. And if you're interested in getting these notes, I can print copies up. It costs about $5 to print up 6 months of notes. So if you're interested in that, we can do that. This is the page of notes for Art 10. Let me just go through it and use that as a template for the presentation today. It begins with a statement, artistic form is consonant with persons. Artistic form is consonant with persons. And then parentheses, just the phrase, artists in life. The second statement is aesthetics is resonant with personality. And then there's the phrase, we can get to know works of art. Far from superficiality, aesthetics, dealing with beauty and the sublime, is about the completion and perfection of ourselves, as was classically considered. To identify, to equivocate, civilized art with cultural craft is an error and a flaw. But the person, the work of art, the artist, beauty, the sublime, are forms in differential consciousness. They do not exist as integrals in nature, so that they do not occur in what we recognize as existence. They do not occur in what we recognize as experience, and they do not even occur in what we recognize as mind. Now, this is very difficult to take, because when you take away existence, you take away experience, and you take away mind, one says, well, all of the actual bases of form and ascription to form are obviated, and this is true. So what is necessary here is to realize it's not that they're taken away. They're there. They work. Existence, experience, mind, they're there. They're working. But when they're all working together, you have something else that comes into play. When existence, experience, and mind are all cooking together, you get a curious quality which is well known to professional chefs. A professional chef knows that no matter how many flavors you put into a dish, the dish itself will have one flavor. It'll have a complex, scintillating series of nuances, but it will have a flavor. And so the really good chef is the one who gets that flavor right with the most nuances. So existence, experience, and mind are always there together, but when the proportions are just right, the flavor that comes out of all three married together is different from any one of them. It's different to experience, it's different to existence is different even to mind. So that the classic word that's used, no matter what language, the classic word that's used is that there's something transcendental about consciousness. That consciousness is different from, or if you're doing a comparison, different to, consciousness is different from, or different to, existence. It's not that it's non-existence. It's remarkably, radically different. And consciousness is not experience. It's radically different from that. Consciousness is not mind. It's radically different to that. This is very difficult to believe. It's difficult to appreciate. Because most of our background, most of our training, most of the world in which we live, most of the people that we know, all that is familiar, all that is secure, all that is trustworthy, generally accepts that consciousness is aligned, has affinity with existence, with experience, with mind. How else, what else could it be? But it's like the chef. The real chef, the artist with food, knows that the dish is going to be different from the ingredients. The ingredients are going to be there, but in, let's use a term that the 20th century favors, but in a subconscious way. So that existence is present subconsciously in consciousness. Experience is present, but subconsciously in consciousness. Mind is present subconsciously in consciousness. So that consciousness has a different energy, a different energy form to existence, experience, and mind. It's like the difference between AC and DC. If you have an appliance from the United States, you can't plug it in Europe. Why? Because the current is a little bit different. You can make a modification. You can have a transformation. You can have a connector, and then it'll work. Traditionally, wisdom always recognized that consciousness was supernatural. It was called for a long time, for thousands of years, it was called magic. Not only did it have an energy different from nature, but it had the uncanny ability to change nature. That whatever forms there were that integrated and worked in nature, they could be changed by consciousness. And the science of that changing was alchemy. That's what it was all about. And somewhere around 5,000 years ago, an enormously shattering realization happened. Our record of it is in ancient Egypt. Our record of it is there in the fourth dynasty of ancient Egypt. The very first pyramid texts, the Pyramid of Unas, 5,000 years ago, records very precisely, very accurately, the realization, the discovery that consciousness could make forms that were completely new, that never existed before. That consciousness adds a dimension to the universe that the universe did not have initially. And that when this dimension is added to the universe becomes protean in the sense that it's able to be many things that it could not be before. One of the forms that came out of this was the transformation of the cave to the mystical sanctuary. And that's what the pyramids were all about. The pyramids were about making conscious forms that were caves that were transformational mystic sanctuaries. Now we know, because the archaeological record by the end of the 20th century is very clear, we know that in Egyptian history, that the first two dynasties had their center at Abydos, because it had been the center of pre-dynastic Egypt. It was the mystical place of Osiris. And the Osirian, as the central temple at Abydos, was the whole foundation of Egyptian civilization in the first and second dynasties. Yeah, we know there was a tremendous kind of a turmoil in the third dynasty, and by the fourth dynasty, the center of Egyptian civilization was moved to where the pyramids are now, moved north quite a long ways. And in the Nile River, the Nile, when you look at Egypt in a north-south map, the Nile River has a very peculiar delta. It has 36-degree delta, which is the exact angle of the open hand, like this, 36 degrees. The Los Angeles Delta is actually precisely 36 degrees. Los Angeles is a, how can we say this? It's an exact reproduction of the Nile Delta. And if you look at the Nile River, it looks just like a spinal column coming down from the brain of the Delta. And exactly where the medulla oblongata would be is where the pyramids are located. That's why they're put there. Where Abydos was where the heart was. But where Memphis was put, where the great pyramids were put, was at the beginnings of the transformation of the spinal column into the brain. Now, Abydos is a natural mystical place. But the pyramids are a conscious mystical place. They're totally different. The pyramids have everything to do with magic. Abydos has to do with the ability. You see how the resistances are? You see how quick your teacher catches it? Hey! Judge Dredd. It's a radical difference to move from the Anahata chakra to the Sahasrara chakra. Why? What's the difference? What's the difference between Abydos and site of the Great Pyramids, Giza? The heart is a natural integral place. There is a heart in nature. Our heartfulness is constantly the locus, the focus, the center of the whole way in which realization takes place in nature. the most developed of all of the Buddhist sutras for the natural process is called the Hridaya Sutra, the Heart Sutra. And every Buddhist monk for 2,500 and some years recites every morning, as soon as he wakes up, recites the short little Heart Sutra. In the Vajrayana, in Tibetan Buddhism, when someone dies, the Rinpoche in charge immediately sends out a mystic vibration of the vowel, which is at the core of the word for heart. Tibetan, being a made-up language, uses a lot of the Sanskrit roots for its cognitive purposes. And the root in Sanskrit and in Tibetan is hri. The Rinpoche will send out vibrations of hri to seal every orifice, the ears, the nostrils, the eyes, the mouth, the anus, sexual organ, to seal so that that entity in that skin, that individual, that example of that species is sealed. Because the efficacy of the Tibetan Book of the Dead only works in a magical way, does not work in a natural way. The natural way is for the goddamn body to decay. That's what happens in nature every single time. So one has to transform that process. And so the psychic alchemy is to seal that form, to complete it, and then to make a transformation of that form into another form, a different form. And the alchemy is the process of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead is a variant, a very late variant, of what originally was the Egyptian Book of the Dead, many thousands of years before. Many. You cannot expect a transformation without first mummifying the body, sending out the hri in the forms of the embalming herbs and all of the other attendant materials. Only when the body is sealed, only when a psychic seal completes the body, is the body then able to be transformed into a transcendent form? This is the nature of the whole process. What comes out of this is that the person is a transcendent form. It doesn't occur in nature at all. Never has. Never will. The conscious person is not a natural occurrence at all. It's always supernatural. Always mystical, if you like. The key to this, the trigger, is to remember that visionary differentiation is a different energy form from natural integration. Natural integration has its ways, has its principles. And they are literally turned inside out by visionary differentiation. Nature, in order to have form, has to have boundedness. Whereas in the magic, mystical realm of consciousness, boundedness is a dead end. It doesn't give form at all, but gives death. Unboundedness is the form in differentiation. So that one can say that the forms of art the forms of persons, the forms of beauty, the forms of the sublime. And sublime is an alchemical term. That's where it comes from. Sublimate. All have to do with an alchemically distilled and mystically resonanced quality of allowing for boundlessness to be the, quote, skin of the form. So that we can say, we can use this kind of language. It sounds very strange to have this kind of language, and yet it's precisely true. Art is talismanic in terms of symbolic resonance. Magic is the field wherein prismatic form constellates differentially. The, quote, skin of form here is liminal membranes, and those liminal membranes have, this is taken from microbiology, not from metaphysics, those liminal membranes have little ionic gates that work by energy excitation and allow for processes to go in and out. This is exactly how cells work, because cells are mystical forms. And when one comes to this understanding that the body already is a mystical form, one realizes that the body was never limited to naturality in the first place. The little blinders in the mind go up, and a little bit of sunlight, slats of sunlight come in, and one gets astounded. Well, that means that nature is already a resonance of a mystical consciousness. Yes, that's what it means. And that the mind, the form of the mind, in differential visionary consciousness, is actually a boundless sequence with thresholds that are those of, the traditional word is joy. There's an energy excitation that's necessary for those thresholds to be crossed, to be activated, those gates to be activated. And the activation comes from one's sense of intense consonance of joy. So that the heart, the Anahata chakra in nature, while it works in an integral way, the mystic heart works in a differential way. It can be overflowing. Now, if you limit the organ of the heart to nature, overflowing means heart attack. The same energy that causes a heart attack in nature causes an overabundance of joy in the mystic. They don't keel over from heart attacks. They glow. One, if one is a doctor of civilization, and there are doctors of civilization, there are beings who look upon civilizations and planets as cases. Bring in the little doctor bag. Oh, this planet is suffering from, and the right medication is, it's like that. And as soon as you see the incidence rise of certain symptoms, one knows, well, that's the disease, that's the illness. Now, in a differential energy, the forms are rather like the scientific form is what we would call a prism. And the closest natural analog to that would be the crystal. But one has to watch because the metaphor of crystal has a whole metaphysic about it, which is misleading. So maybe it might be easier to talk about liquid crystal, liquid crystals. Because the threshold phase equilibria of liquid crystals gets much closer to the actuality. Now you can go into this. Here's a volume from the Princeton Science Library, Time Frames, The Evolution of Punctuated Equilibria. Niles Eldridge, chairman and curator of Invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, authored many, many, many books. He comes to it from studying trilobites, billion-year-old fossils of living organisms that lived when life first on this particular planet started to take form. And he became astounded that the more that you look at what was real about these forms billion years ago, shows that the understanding of evolution, the understanding of change, the understanding of development is rather misplaced. And he writes this kind of language. Then, too, organisms are invariably born or otherwise spring into being, as when a simple parental hydroid living in a lake buds off a miniature version of itself by asexual fission. No organism lives forever, and that means not only all eventually die, but that all are born as well. The span of time between birth and death is finite. This temporal boundedness of organisms is as clear to all of us as the spatial boundedness provided by our skins. All of this boundedness of organisms, obvious as it is an important aspect of the singularity of an organism, the properties that help make it an individual. But we need to shake the dust off and realize that the boundedness here is not some kind of Cartesian geometrizing that makes something like brick walls in flesh, but that the term membrane, the microbiological term membrane, comes into play much, much better. And just as skin, the amazingly complex living organism, membranes also. And that in a membrane structure, in all organic forms, whether it's on this planet or any other planet, it doesn't make any difference in any star system. The thresholds of energy transfer out of organic membranes are always in terms of gates or thresholds held by certain atoms of very limited elements, usually calcium, sometimes sodium, sometimes potassium. Those elements, atoms of those elements embedded into the membrane structure, are the places, the windows, the doors, by which energy, at certain thresholds of excitation, are able to come in and out. So that membranes are permeable. Permeable. They allow for two processes at the same time. They give definition and they allow for expansion. And so, leaping over all kinds of intermediate things, one can say that there's a very peculiar kind of prism that the person actually constitutes, and that is a double prism. The double prism. not just the nice little prism, say like Sir Isaac Newton, but a double prism that does two processes that in nature would be antithetical, but in consciousness, in magic, are complementarities. They work together very well. And they're expressed by the infinity sign, classically. And that, or the Tao symbol, the Tai Chi. That wholeness is a differential wholeness. And it works better and better the more that it is given an open field of variation and freedom to work in. The individual actually works better, prospers, the more variabilities that there are. So that the protection of individuality in consciousness is maintained by the guarantee of open freedom as a field of play. Now that requires a real alchemical revolution in political consciousness. It means that the old brick wall forms of traditional cultures are completely dead ends for the differential person. It's not a judgment about their value. It's an assessment of a structural impossibility. So when you're going to have differential conscious people, they literally need to have a universe of freedom. Otherwise, they can't breathe. They suffocate. They have to be able to play. That's the way that they live. Now, Kandinsky, in Concerning the Spiritual Art, writing about movement, page 27 in this version, this printing of it, the life of the spirit may be graphically represented as a large acute-angled triangle divided horizontally into unequal parts with the narrowest segment uppermost. The lower the segment, the greater is its breadth, depth, and area. The whole triangle moves slowly and almost invisibly forward and upward. Where the apex was today, the second segment will be tomorrow. What today can be understood only by the apex is tomorrow the thought and feeling of the second segment. So that in a differential conscious universe, the very first crossing of the threshold is always done by one initially. One. In other words, it's not like an evolution of a new species happens by all of a sudden there being lots of examples of the species. It's always a pinpoint, exact, precise penetration of one. And as long as the universe of freedom in play, as long as the condition of boundlessness is provided, that one will continue to pull resonantly after he or she the opportunity for unlimited others. Now, this is a very peculiar thing. Schiller, in the 11th letter, writes, this is section 8 of the 11th letter. A personality considered for itself alone and independently of all sense material is merely the predisposition to a possible expression of his infinite nature. Now infinite nature. Notice how consciousness is at home in infinity. And one has to read logically here that consciousness is always at home, not only in infinity, but in its complement void. An emendation here. Mind is never at home in void. Never. Mind blinks out of existence in void. If you look at the visual sequence that the great Takuan in Japan designed about 400 or 500 years ago, called the Ten Bowls, there's a panel in the ninth spot of the Ten Bulls, which is blank. The mind, when it comes into juxtaposition with the void, integrates the void into itself, and one gets nil, zip, nada, which is not a period. It's not a dead end. It is an integration of void. And the only way that mystics ever talk about this, the only way that's talked about in Zen, is that later on you chuckle over the fact that you were not. And it's a paradox. Oh yeah, I was not. When he was invited to the United States, we've talked about this several times, the young D.T. Suzuki, it's like a raccoon, right, with the cords, technological python. What do I care? His master, D.T. Suzuki's master, is in the 1890s, 100 years ago, Shoyin Shaku Roshi. He said, you cannot go to the United States and teach Dharma unless you know Dharma yourself and you haven't had any experience of Satori. And obviously, your whole import is to go to the United States and translate and teach Dharma. So the obvious conclusion, Japanese are very obvious about these conclusions. He said, if you do not have your enlightenment the next few days, you'll have to kill yourself. Because the boat is leaving and you should go with it, and you can't go with it unless you're enlightened, so you have a few days to live. And on the last evening, the ego just is so melodramatic. The very last evening, around midnight, he finally realized, the 20-year-old D.T. Suzuki realized he wasn't going to make it, and he gave up. He let it go, which is what you should do. And so he came out of the Zendo and he said he was absolutely astounded in his own writing when he was close to 90. He wrote this down. He said he looked out and all the trees were transparent. And he said he looked down and he was transparent too. So he got to go. Schiller, his personality considered for itself alone and independently of all sense material, is merely the predisposition to a possible expression of his infinite nature. And as long as he has neither perceptions nor sensations, he is nothing but form and empty potential. A little bit of German Zen here. Well, don't be surprised. D.T. Suzuki thought the greatest Western Zen master was Meister Eckhart, who lived 500 years before Scheller. What does it say? As long as he has neither perceptions nor sensations, he is nothing but form and empty potential. His sensuous nature, considered for itself alone and apart from any spontaneous activity of the mind can do more, no more than reduce him, who without it is nothing but form, into matter, but can in no wise bring it about that he becomes conjoined with matter. In other words, we're of a very peculiar nature. When it comes right down to it, when we try to stuff ourselves into matter, matter itself doesn't stuff into matter, so how can we? When you try to stuff matter into the rational Cartesian forms that it should have, it radiates. That great atomic chef, Marie Curie, noticed that radium does not stay in its form. It should stay in its form. It doesn't stay in its form. It has radiation. What's going on here? What's going on here is that the forms of matter are energy thresholds, and that the content of those energy thresholds are electrical potentials of the negative kind. So that in a kind of a Marx Brothers universe way, electrons are used to saying no all the time. They're not going to stay there. The only reason they stay there is that the energy is precise, and if it is anything other than that precision, they jump ship. They go to the next energy level, and if there's not another energy level, they go to some other atom. And what do they leave behind? They leave behind an ionic hole. An ionic hole. That's what's in the membranes of the cells of living tissues, ionic holes left by electrons escaping from the atoms of calcium or sodium, sometimes potassium, so that the membranes have little micro subatomic holes in them, and that's how energy goes in between, and that's why cells are alive. That's why they can work together. What does Lao Tzu say? He says, heaven's net is vast. It's still a net, but it's very vast. It's also very small. It's incredibly subatomic. That's how life works. That's how matter works. And you can't stuff matter into matter. How are you going to stuff a mystical, eternal spirit into some little construct that doesn't even exist in its own self? You can't. So that you get this popping the champagne cork, ebullience, and consciousness is a joy of release from the stupid expectations of a confining that never worked in the first place. And the form that comes out of the consciousness, the very first form that comes out, is the double prism of the person. The very first objectivity in consciousness is the infinite person. There's nothing else that can live in that realm of complete joy and perfect boundlessness. Only the double prismatic person can live there. And the cosmos is a consonance, the largest consonance of that form. Let's take a break. This is a book called Psychological Types. It's one of the most influential books of the 20th century. It's by Carl Jung. Psychological Types, or The Psychology of Individuation. They don't give the original. The original was in the First World War era and reprinted many times. And I believe it's volume 6 in the collected works. About 90 pages of Psychological Types concerns itself with Schiller. guess you never read Jung. A lot of people talk about Jung. Very few people read Jung. And when we turn to chapter 2 of the Psychological Types, the headline is Schiller's Ideas Upon the Type Problem. And then in bold print, Letters and the Aesthetic Education of Man, which is what we're using. So rather than going to third-hand people who have read only second-hand reports of Jung, let's go to what Jung went to in the first place to understand psychological types. Why? Because we don't want to waste time. Why go to weekends with third-rate people using second-hand information on stuff that's already derivative? And it costs more. I don't get it. Sorry. And at the very end, at the very beginning, the superior and inferior functions. The superior and inferior functions. Jung, with truthful humility, so far as my somewhat limited range extends, Friedrich Schiller seems to have been the first to have made any considerable attempt at a conscious discrimination of typical attitudes and to have developed a fairly complete presentation of their singularities. Well, does that mean that Schiller in this book is the first person to have really gotten human types down into a precise conscious formulation? Conscious formulation, yes. And at the very end of that 90-page section, the last section is the idealist and the realist. I won't read it, but you can get out of this the sense of how glib people in the 20th century have made a polarity out of idealists and realists, and that's not the point at all. That's not even the point in Jung, especially is not the point in Schiller. The double prism of the person does both. One cannot be a real realist without being also an ideal idealist at the very same time. Otherwise, there's no one there. Those two functions happen together. They're like two hands that work together. And to be stupid, pardon me, and say that, oh, well, I'm a realist and you're an idealist, is gibberish. That's first sign of the doctor needs to be called. The appearance of polarities in a person is a first symptom of regression. If one is not dealing with the resonances of complementarity, then you're dealing with something in an integral mode, which is, it means a tribal illness. And there's no therapy, there's no therapeutic process in nature to handle that, because everything in nature fortifies those compartmentalized conditions. That's what nature does, because it maintains its natural form that way. It's like consciousness is a radioactivity, and once you've become conscious, you're radioactive. You can't go back and then just play at being natural again. You're going to contaminate everybody in the tribe. And first thing they're going to do is they're going to make sure to scapegoat you and get rid of you. Lakonscious individual in the culture is persona non grata. They don't want you. You're not going to fit in nicely. You're not going to behave. You can't behave. You can't fit in because you're already larger, because your energy levels are opened up. Even if you want to, you can't be stuffed back into those forms. And to try to do that, all the laws of nature now are shark's teeth that work against you. And you're going to shred yourself brutally by trying to cram yourself back into a situation that can't happen in the first place. Jean-Paul Sartre calls this condemned to freedom, this condition. There's no sense in weeping about it. So Schiller writes, as long as he merely feels, merely desires, and acts upon mere desire, he is as yet nothing but world. And you fit in. You fit into the world, however it's going, whatever the modicum is, whatever the century, whatever the millennium, whatever the geographic position on whatever planet, you will fit in. You will blend in. As long as he merely feels, merely desires, and acts upon mere desire, he is as yet nothing but world. If by this term we understand nothing but the formless content of time, true, it is his sensuous nature alone which can turn this potential into actual power, but it is only his personality which makes all his actual activity into something which is inalienably his own personality. There are psychological types to personality, because a typology is a differential analytical format, antithetical to a conditional limitation on an integral cycle. The logic is brutal. There's no way around it. But the import of it is joyous because it gives us a reality which is in every instant of opportunity. That's why they used to talk in the late 19th century, later on in the 19th century, when Schiller's thought really found people who understood what he was doing. Jung follows up Schiller in psychological types with Nietzsche. Because the very next phase beyond Schiller is Nietzsche. Nietzsche's profundity in his study of tragedy, the form of tragedy, what's going on here? The form of tragedy is a conscious form which has a double prismatic person structure. And the very essence of tragedy is for a conscious person to try and fit back in, weave themselves back into a limited conditional cultural, tribal, mythic horizon where they are not going to fit anymore because the gods of that level are going to kill you. They have to. The devotees of those gods are going to kill you. That's their function. That's how those conditions stay healthy in their limitedness, is to make sure that no outlaws, no exceptions are loose. So that the artist is very peculiar. The artist needs freedom in order to really exist. The differential variability of freedom is the natural heir of the artist. I have to have it. They cannot be confined. They cannot fit in. Schiller writes, "In order, therefore, not to be mere world, he must impart form to matter." That's why artists make things. "In order, therefore, not to be mere world, he must impart form to matter. In order to not be mere form, he must give reality to the predisposition he carries within him." You've got a realization within him as a predisposition. It's a radiation that now is activated. The electrons have moved to high enough levels where one is now ionized and one is open to the universe. He gives reality to form. He gives reality to form. The artist makes things that are real. They're not imitations at all. They're not representations at all. They're not totemic. They're not amulets. They're not fetishes. They're forms of the real. That's why we call it creative. Ibn Arabi called it creative imagination. He gives reality to form when he brings time into being. When he confronts changelessness with change, the eternal unity of his own self with the manifold variety of the world. That's an alchemy. He gives form to matter when he annuls time again. When he affirms persistence within change and subjugates the manifold variety of the world to the unity of his own self. Well, this is powerful stuff. Even Grandpa Jung paid attention to Schiller, because on this score, the man is precise. It's a conscious language showing beautifully what the score is, what the game is. Our position. And so Schiller brings the 11th letter to this conclusion. From this, that not only this paragraph that we've been working on this morning, but from the whole letter, which there are copies of here, if you haven't been able to find your book. He says, from this there proceed two contrary challenges to man, the two fundamental laws of his sensual rational nature. The first insists upon absolute reality. You're never going to settle for something less than what is real to you now that you are activated. It's never going to happen. You're going to become sicker than dogs if you lie to yourself. And the more that you lie, the more sick you become. Your body absolutely just will not accept it. Much less the psyche, much less consciousness. It's like trying to make little children lie. They're not going to do it. People say, well, old children don't understand. Oh, yes, they do understand. You try to make a two-year-old lie. They will play forever. They will not lie. The first insists upon, out of two, the first insists upon absolute reality. He is to turn everything which is mere form into world and make all his potentialities fully manifest. Bring it out of yourself in resonance. The second insists upon absolute formality. He is here to destroy everything in himself which is mere world and bring harmony into all his changes. This is a Pythagorean harmonia. That means all the energy levels resonating in the same scale, like music. In other words, he is to externalize all that is within him and give form to all that is outside of him at the same time. Both these tasks conceived in their highest fulfillment lead us back to that concept of Godhead from which I started. And there he ends the 11th letter and begins the 12th letter. And the 12th begins towards the accomplishment of this twofold task, expressing the within out and bringing the without in to form. Where did we hear that before? That's the very process that established existence. Or as the Japanese say, ne, ne. When they want you to get something, they say, ne. And in our education, exactly, when we started making masks, we made two masks, you remember? When we dealt with the second phase of our education, when we dealt with ritual comportment, which is what existence objectively really is, it's what we do. What we do establishes the extent. And in order to establish that for ourselves, we made masks. We made two masks, a pair of masks. One mask of a food and one mask of a feeling. And it seemed at the time, I know it seemed at the time, like first grade assignment. Geez, what kind of superior education is this? We're making masks like school children. That's right. But we're not just making masks like school children. We're making a pair of masks. A mask of a food, which is something of the world, something without that comes in, and a mask of feeling, something from ourselves, which goes out. And where those two masks interface right there is an ionic channel on the membrane of the real. Right there. And any good tribal chieftain, any good medicine man, any good holy woman who understands how to secure the health of the tribe makes sure that those ionic channels, those open points are established in the dances, the rituals, the myths, the ceremonies of their people. Otherwise, they're not going to be healthy. They need that. And though nobody in the tribe can inhabit those spaces completely, their function as a people depends upon the health of the interchange of energy through those thresholds, through those gates. And the whole purpose of ceremony is to establish those. And to misunderstand that is to make graven images. You do not call God forth by making golden calves. You call God forth by making a holy space in the very center of the people where he can come in and be at home. If you make a golden calf, you're trying to stuff the universe's spirit into some little petty trinket. Yahweh's not going to buy the tiki god approach. And it's not because you're not a Hawaiian Jew. It's just simply that it doesn't happen that way at all. The efficacy of the holy people of a tribe, or a culture is that they remember exactly precisely how to make sacred forms of presence wherein the divine can come and be at home with the people where they come together. And the only difference is that when you're an individual, you do that completely with your own structure. You have to make a presence space in yourself. You have to make an open void in yourself so that the divine can come and inhabit that. That's called the soul, and the soul is no thing. That's a graven image. That's golden calf shit. And all this writing by all these so-called religious experts about the soul are just so much waste paper. The only time Jesus lost his temper was in the temple, right? Because they're selling shit to take the place of sacred openness. Schiller writes at the beginning of the 12th letter, towards the accomplishment of this twofold task, something within resonating out, at the same time, something without constellating within, so that resonance and constellation happen together. And when they happen together, in that membrane is established a constance which maintains the objective form of harmony and creates a cosmos. Not only is the person created and becomes real, but the cosmos for the very first time becomes real. And in the ancient Plotinian rendition of the wisdom tradition, the person is beautiful and the cosmos is sublime. Towards the accomplishment of this twofold task of giving reality to the necessity within and subjecting to the law of necessity the reality without, we are impelled by two opposing forces which, since they drive us to the realization of their object, may be aptly termed drives. And this is the source of the whole language called drives. Because not only did Jung read Schiller, but Freud read Schiller also. Why? Because this is where the conscious intelligence really hammered it out. On the patient anvil of somebody doing the necessary original work year in and year out until it was done right. It's like a craftsman in language getting it so this is how to say this so that we can understand what it is that we're trying to do. And here it is. And we're trying to do two motions at once, which if kept in a delimited integral mode produce polarity, conflict, tensions, death, madness, the whole thing. Does it mean then that we are condemned to this impossibility? No, it means then that nature has to transform. And the whole difference between the Hermetic wisdom and a Gnostic myth is that one understands that one has to transform. You have to come out of that horizon completely. You have to be the ancient Hermetic emblem of this is Hermes holding the caduceus aloft like a torch and reaching down with the other hand to pull the guy out of the hole. Out of the hole of whatever it is that you're in. Death, madness, poverty, whatever it is, to bring you out. And if you take that Hermetic caduceus and you turn that towards the world, not upside down, but turn it towards the world, you get the interchange of the two serpents that are exactly the structure of the Kundalini of the spinal column. That's exactly where it comes. And the sun that's at the center of that now becomes the glow at the very core of the interchange, the sexual interchange. Schiller writes, the first of these, two drives, he says, because of the nature that we're, there's this impelled quality to them, we can call them drives. Indeed, they're very much like drives. The first of these, which I will call the sensuous drive, proceeds from the physical existence of man. The honesty of the body being exactly real, needs this. And it's not on level of petty need. It's not on level of surreptitious need. It's not on level of repressed need. It's basic universal drive. The sensuous drive proceeds from the physical existence of man or his sensuous nature. Its business is to set him within the limits of time and turn him into matter so one can objectively, existentially be, which sets a fount basis for the development of the further integration. Not to provide him with matter, since that, of course, would presuppose a free activity of the person capable of receiving such matter and distinguishing it from the self as from that which persists. But by matter, in this context, we understand nothing more than change or reality which occupies time. And so the classic formulation is always a time-bound form. Existence is a time-bound form. The skin of existence is time, a time form. But time forms can be transformed when raised to energy thresholds where the time form integrity is permeated by ionic channels that are left at strategic places because of the rise of an energy level. Time forms are no different than any other form. This book cannot exist if you raise even one variable called temperature beyond Fahrenheit 451. It transforms into flame right away. Becomes a series of ash and gas right away. Just raising temperature, which is nothing to your universal spirit. Your universal spirit has parameters of maybe 20, 30 million variables that it can access almost immediately. So transforming form is no big thing at all. It's rather easy. What's difficult is waking up from the prison of saying no to higher realities, of learning something new. That's difficult. That's really hard. Schiller writes, this state, which is nothing but time occupied by content, is called, and it's a colloquial phrase which comes in, the sensuous. Time occupied by content, called sensation. And it is through this alone that physical existence makes itself known. Now, this is not petty at all. No logic in the world was more highly developed than the Gupta Indian logic. Indian logic in the third, fourth centuries of our era was as powerful, as detailed, as smooth as any logic on the planet ever has been. More so than Bertrand Russell, more so than contemporary computers. And the whole foundation upon which Indian logic at its apex rests is that the propositional actuality founds itself upon feeling, sensation, rather than mental ideation. Its basis is there. If we had time enough, we could go into it. Can be gone into with unbelievable learnedness. Schiller writes, since everything that exists in time exists as a succession, the very fact of something existing at all means that everything else is excluded. And that's how evolution makes things, makes species. By time frames, and the sequence of punctuated equilibria achieving a sustainable form, at least sustainable in terms of conditionals. This form can be sustained about 7 years. It needs to have total revision of its cellular structure. But you can keep more or less this form for maybe 90 years with meditation about 120 years. But the whole reality of it is based upon a conditional cinching of the phase form succession in time. And nature has to obey that. And perhaps obey is the wrong word, because it isn't an obedience at all. It just simply, as Lucretius said, de rerum natura, the way things are. But we don't have to stay limited by that at all, because our ability to transform is infinite. Infinite. And one can make a succession of lives just as easy as a succession of cells. There's no big thing about it at all. Nothing at all to it. It's literally child's play. So to be fearful of the delimiting conditions of an integral process is really being not only, what's the old American Western term, buffaloed? It's being double buffaloed, triple buffaloed, really. You're letting other people fool you. You're fooling yourself. And the whole context within which the belief structure is fooled already. So that the ignorance has penetrated down to a complicated gunk, which is very difficult to disturb, because you have to literally dissolve all of it in order to get it into a solution, so that then you can do something with it. You can do whatever you want with it once it's in solution. Once your eternal spirit has dissolved out of the delimited gunk, the cosmos entertains whatever variation you want to do. But the fount of this is not in a religious doctrine. There's no way a religious doctrine can contain that. The fount is not in a psychological profile. A profile's boundedness is several orders inferior to that necessary to even sustain graspability, much less the transformative process. One of the most difficult processes in alchemy is to maintain what is called in alchemy the refining fire. The problem of the crucible, of the form that's going to hold the process, is minuscule when compared to the application of the refining fire. Because it's only a kind of relentless dedication applied with a just so middle firmness. What did the Buddha say? He called his dharma the middle way. Not too much, not too little. The middle way. Because that refining fire, that process, that dedication held exactly, wends its way through all of the phases of integration and comes out on the differential high side. Why does it do this? Because the real is real in just this way. It never was other than this. It always was real in this way. And so when one looks, since we're talking about Buddhism for the moment, when one looks to the perfections in the high Dharma, to the paramitas, one finds that there are six. There are three that can be given to children and animals. They are so simple and basic because they work on the existential, bodily level where children and animals are at home, and you can start with those. And those three, when they transform into differential mode, become very powerful high Dharma perfections. And the three that are there on the integral level, for children and for animals, harmless, you can give that to all of them. Dana, which is translated as giving, givingness. Kshanti, which is patience. And sila, which usually is translated as morality. But what it means is an order which has its cultural or tribal sustainability. That means people can live with it for a long time together. Sila, Dana, and Kshanti. And those three, when they go through transformation, when they go through realization, become very powerful. Very, very powerful. Patience becomes, the Sanskrit term for it is virya, virile. Strength. Not just strength, but virility, virya. And sila becomes dhyana, which means concentration, which means dhyana, eventually means zen. It means that kind of powerfulness, concentration. Virya and dhyana, and dana, which seems like the simplest of all, becomes prajna, becomes wisdom. And one realizes in prajna that there could have been no wisdom without compassion, and that the very essence of giving is compassion. Why is it essential? Because it never could have happened. It would have had nothing to work with and become what it is through transformation without that. It's the soil of wisdom is compassion. Sharing. Why? Why is that so? Because it never was other than that in reality. It's not only that no man is an island, it's that no atom exists outside of the universe of atomic structure. The shared structureness of it all is what makes it real. It's hard to get those plural or grammatical constructs. So let's jump over here. When we're talking about the transformative differential energies that now can deal with infinites and voids and the cosmos as a whole. One cannot expect then that one is throwing away lowly things like myth and ritual and symbol. They are preserved. But they're preserved in their integrational qualities, not some parallel version of them projected irrationally into consciousness. This is the very essence of fantasizing, the very essence of the neurotic. To try to take the bones that served you to hold things together here and to make those heavenly bones. Well, geez, if I can't take this into heaven, then I don't want heaven. I gotta have blue eyes, I gotta have, you know, the whole. It's the height of ignorance. It's irrelevant, actually. Here's Stravinsky. In the Poetics of Music, I guess maybe you don't know, when Stravinsky was invited to Harvard to give these lectures, he was, Russian was his natural language, and he couldn't speak English. And he wanted to write them in French, but his French was very mystical, and so he had to have somebody help him. And they were delivered in French at Harvard and only translated later, about 7-8 years later, into English. So the English translation is a little off. Poétique musicale, I think, was the original title of the Poetics of Music. But it comes through in this way. As for culture, he writes, it is a sort of upbringing which in the social sphere confers polish upon education, sustains and rounds out academic instruction. This upbringing is just as important in the sphere of taste and is essential to the creator, who must ceaselessly refine his taste or run the risk of losing his perspicacity. Our mind as well as our body requires continual exercise. It atrophies if we do not cultivate it. So that the whole fabric, of Stravinsky's very conscious musical forms. I mean, he was at the avant-garde of developing musical forms that were never heard before. They're now in the late 20th century, very hearable, very feelable. But when they first came out, people had some trouble. But when you look at the content, the programmatic content of that, those musical structures, the early ones are all mythic. They're all mythic. The Rite of Spring, Petrushka, the Firebird, the Wedding, Reynard the Fox, the whole thing. Stravinsky, like a very great artist, preserves the mythic. And when he starts in the late 1920s to go into classical symbolic form, the first really great composition was the Oedipus Rex. He took Sophocles' tragedy and put it into a musical form. And then he took Apollo. He did the ballet Apollo. And with Oedipus Rex and with Apollo and later on with Persephone and Orpheus and so forth, you find the mythic merging into classic symbolic form. But all the time, Stravinsky is opening up the conscious art of music into realms which had never been explored before. Just simply never been explored. Why was this not explored before? Because it didn't exist before. Made something absolutely new in the cosmos, enlarged the space by conscious refinement wherein mythic feeling could then populate it, so that one not only saves the universe for consciousness to explore, but widens the sphere where myth can still be myth. It's like an adult who inhabits a new land so that the children can play. One is not throwing myth away. One is not throwing ritual away. One is not throwing symbols away, but enlarging the domains where they can be what they are. The proviso is not an either or. The proviso is to maintain a wisdom about keeping both, and in harmonic proportion, viable together. And that's a difficult thing. And the most difficult of it all is because if the education is mishandled, if the education is mishandled, differential vision becomes an automatic abort threshold, and people regress. It's like an automatic response. It's almost like an autonomic response. And the, excuse me, but the traditional religious solution to make ceremonial forms which a precious few will control, so that they can then usher through everybody else to some kind of safe other shore, is fictive. It never happens. Not one of those priests is in heaven. No, none of them made it. Not one of those rabbis made it. Not one of those mullahs is there. Just to conclude, the Buddha was asked once. He was asked this. He's near the end of his life. He's about 80 years old. One of the most powerful of all the logical monks, Moggallana, asked him. He said, in your deep Dharma vision, has anyone ever been enlightened using a method other than the one which you teach? And his answer was, not a single one. And so another monk named Sariputra, who was famous for his compassion, said, well, in your omniscience, how many using this method have in the past, before you taught this method, achieved enlightenment? He said, without limit. So there's good news and bad news. The good news is that it's absolutely true. The bad news is that you don't believe it.